Patrick Mazza, welcome again to Cable.
Hi, Bill. Good to be back.
Patrick Mazza is an independent journalist, researcher, and activist focused on his beat, his climate, and global sustainability. He's an old friend from here in Portland, founded and edited the late lamented Portland Alliance newspaper. He moved to Seattle, where he founded and was research director at Climate Solutions. That was through 2013. Patrick, why don't you give us, you know, the thumbnail sketch of your recent organization work and activism?
Sure.
And your several arrests.
Yeah. In 2014, I was arrested in front of an oil train at BNSF Delta Yard in Everett, Washington. And we actually were able to conduct in 2016 the first climate civil disobedience necessity defense in an American courtroom, where we argued that, yeah, sure, we committed a crime, but it was to prevent the greater harm of climate change and exploding oil trains. Unfortunately, the judge didn't let the jury consider the evidence, but it was a first. And then a couple of years back in 2019, to support the campaign to get Chase to stop being the biggest bank funder of fossil fuels, I got arrested here at Chase Westlake Branch in Seattle and spent a few hours in King County Jail. Ironic for the county that's renamed itself Martin Luther King. So functionally, I was in Martin Luther King County Jail. I didn't have time to write any letters, but I basically, in recent years, I returned to direct action. The climate movement is something really different than it was years ago when we founded Climate Solutions. The movement has moved to the streets in recent years. So a lot more young people, a lot more of an attitude of protest, naming the enemy, which is the fossil fuel industry and its allies, and direct action. And that has had a lot to do with elevating the issue to a point where, you know, even Joe Biden says it's an existential crisis. So I'm currently president of the board of 350 Seattle. We're the independent local affiliate of 350.org. We're actually noted in the 350 network as one of the most forward in direct action. 350 PDX is, of course, right up there. And I also have recently started up a Substack, theraven.substack.com, where I'm kind of reviving my old independent journalism gig. Going to be doing some stuff, which is obviously climate's important, but really on the political fractures in the United States and what we're facing in the next 10 years, which is some pretty serious stuff. So anyway, you know, that's the kind of stuff I've been up to in recent years.
So, Patrick, today on the Old Mole, we're going to be discussing a number of difficult subjects, hard issues, the balance between direct action struggles and the struggles in city councils and the public utility commissions and the legislatures and the Congress. Those struggles are also extremely important. We have to get the means to do what we know we can do. And I know that the 350.org is, in fact, getting much more involved in those struggles, which is extremely welcome. And we also have to talk about the city and the importance of the city and the roles of the city and the state and national government. First, though, you've written out a lot of the many things that have to be accomplished in order to meet the 10-year deadline. Climate scientists have set that deadline. And if we don't do significant things and hard things in the next 10 years, we risk feedback loops that could, in fact, lead to an irreversible global roasting, making the planet uninhabitable for humans. So give us a sense of what has to be done.
What the scientists are telling us is basically to have a chance of staying in with no more global heating than 1.5 degrees centigrade, which is roughly 3 degrees Fahrenheit. Or, you know, we will be pushing the climate system in ways that we don't fully understand, but the hotter we get, the more likely it is to set off feedback loops. I mean, we're already seeing feedback loops. We're already seeing the Arctic ice melt and cause greater heating in the Arctic and it feeding back into the global weather system. We're already seeing fires, wildfires in our forests. So we're already seeing feedback loops. It's just a question of bringing global climate pollution down quickly enough to tamp down the heating, frankly, to leave the world, to leave a world which our kids can cope with. I mean, we're going to be adapting to dramatically changed climates. We've gone too late. But it's a whole question of overstressing the adaptive capacities of civilization. So the things we need to do to really dramatically reduce global climate emissions, we need to get off fossil fuels as much as we can in every way we can. That involves shutting down a lot of coal-fired and gas-fired power plants, replacing them with solar and wind energy. It involves lots of energy efficiency. It involves really massively retrofitting buildings, shifting the energy source of buildings from gas and oil to electricity. It involves building, when we are building new buildings, to build them super efficient. And really, most of the buildings we'll have in 2050 we have now. So we need to retrofit the current building stock. We need to move more into transportation alternatives. I mean, we need electric buses, and we need more of them. We need to make it easier for people to ride bicycles. We have really tough land use problems in our country because we sprawled out. So we do need electric cars for that long term. And really, it's going to take not just 10 years, it's going to take 50 years to work that problem out. So we need to do that. We need to replace fossil fuels and industry. We need to reform agriculture in ways that build soil rather than exhaust it. And, you know, people are saying we need to reduce animal agriculture, especially beef. You know, there's other things. We definitely need to, as much as possible, stop deforestation, such as the old growth being cut up in British Columbia. And we need to start replanting forests. And we need to not count that as, you know, we need to get off this kind of idiocy of forest carbon offsetting and just plant forests just to soak carbon out of the atmosphere, not to balance new carbon growing in forest with a power plant operating somewhere. So that's brief. That's really a simplification. But in general, we need to do everything we can to reduce the use of fossil fuels, to reduce deforestation, and to reform agriculture so it builds soils rather than exhausts them.
One final thing. I think you exhausted my list, but it also has to happen on an international basis. This is Bill Resnick talking to Patrick Mazza, a journalist. Stopping Climate Change is his beat. He's written books and hundreds of papers, articles, funding proposals. He's president of the board of 350.org, which is an independent affiliate of National 350.
Pardon me, it's 350 Seattle. President of the board of 350 Seattle.
Okay. Let's start with one of the great issues that we face, which has to do with the roles of city, state, and national governments in doing all of those things. And in particular, I think it's important to talk about the coming energy system and who's going to fund it and where they're going to go and how we're going to superintend and build the crusade for energy use reduction and energy conservation. Without that latter, without the energy use reduction, we're going to be lost. If we continue, we just will not be able to build out renewable clean energy fast enough if we were going to, in fact, meet all of the energy needs of the world as they're now defined. Let's discuss your vision of the city and state and national governments.
I mean, state governments have a massive role to play in both energy and transportation. State governments, all states have public utility commissions that regulate private investor-owned utilities. They can mandate that utilities do things such as have more renewable energy, fund more conservation. They basically regulate the utilities' profits. They have a hammer on the utilities. So generally, those are appointed by the governor of the state, the members of that board. So there's a lot of focus on influencing public utility commissions. States have a massive role to play in transportation. I mean, states get some money from the federal government, but they plan transportation. So, I mean, we have this example here between the states of Washington and Oregon, where we have two governors who are supposed climate champions who are both supporting a new Columbia River crossing to replace the interstate bridge. And that's just going to be a massive sprawl machine for Clark County and increase greenhouse gases. So why are supposedly progressive states that are advancing climate policies doing this kind of thing? So we need a lot of citizen pressure put on state governments in areas like that. City governments are increasingly moving to create climate plans that involve all kinds of stuff, you know, from reducing food waste, which is pretty important, to improving public transit. Cities have a lot to do. Cities have their own building codes. Building codes have everything to do with how efficient your buildings are going to be. In fact, you know, Portland was the first city in the country to start a climate plan way back in 93, and it's had some success in reducing emissions per capita. So cities have an important role to play. And again, that's pressure on mayors, pressure on city councils. It takes people movements to put enough pressure on. So the national government, we're seeing some potential progress under Biden, but with the whole mess in Congress, I don't know how much we'll see. The real focus of climate action, really since Bush got elected in 2000, has moved to states and cities. A number of states have, you know, a lot of states have what are called renewable portfolio standards, which mandate that you use so much clean or renewable energy. Washington State in 2019 passed a mandate for 100% clean energy by 2045. Now, there's some leeway in that for stuff we don't like, which I think is unlikely to happen, like nuclear. But the hopeful piece is that solar and wind have tremendously come down in price to where they are the most economical, cheapest new energy source. Last year, 90% of the new power plant additions in the world were solar and wind. Should be 100%, but, you know, so we've got a lot of policy levers at the city and state level, and that's primarily where I've worked through my time in climate. We've worked to get renewable energy standards in Oregon and Washington, and also worked to create some supports for new industries to help infant industries grow. You know, there's people working transportation. Because we have all the hydro dams, we wouldn't want to build them again, but we have them now. Transportation is our biggest greenhouse gas source in the Northwest. It's the cars. Basically anything that can get people out of cars and into transit or other modes. That's all important leverage points to push on. And unfortunately, there's too much business as usual thinking in agencies. They need to be pushed by people. And I think more and more they need to be pushed by people in the streets.
No question about that. But let me challenge you, Patrick. Portland has a beautiful plan. It's beautifully illustrated. It's well over 100 pages, very detailed, beautiful pictures, thoughtful expositions, and they've done almost nothing. The per capita use has gone down because the car mileage is so much better right now.
Mm-hmm.
Really, our consumption in Portland is enormous. Compared to Washington and California, Oregon and Portland has done very, very, very little. California, for example, now has a mandate all new homes require solar. But much more than that, California has a very vigorous program of taming and reconstructing the utility sector. And in fact, now half of the energy in California, half of the customers are served by public agencies, all of whom are trying to build out in the cities and counties where they're located to build out if they had the money. Los Angeles has the money because it has the Department of Power and Water, which is a public agency. It's a public electricity agency that can use Los Angeles' credit rating to build out wind energy. A lot of it in the city, on rooftops, along right-of-ways, along streets. Some of it larger installations on vacant and brownfields land. Some much larger utility-scale wind plantations just 50 and 70 miles east of it in the high desert. Fairly large plants. They have to spend a little money on the big grid, but nothing like the big grid that the investor-owned utilities want to build in the state and in the country. There's a vast amount of subsidies going to go to them if they win that struggle right now in Congress of who gets the money for infrastructure. California has done a great deal to enormously increase its renewable energy production. Los Angeles, for example, the area now on a sunny day with moderate winds can produce in the summer more than 100% of Southern California's needs for electricity. That is the area's needs for electricity. All they need is storage, and they can, in fact, increase, even with what they have now, and they're building out more, they can go through many, many parts of the year on purely sun and wind as they are closing down gas plants and eliminating coal plants throughout the whole of California. Washington, you know Washington better than I do, but you've done a lot, and especially with regard to transit. My sense is that the city has to lead the way in somehow leveraging their power and their capacity to build out the energy systems that the investor-owned utilities will not do, and who, in fact, the entirety of the corporate apparatus wants to have business as usual. Anyway, that's my challenge to you, Patrick. I think the cities have such an important role, especially in the next 10 years. It has to be done fairly soon, and the cities have the capacity to do it if they had the money, because the generating units of solar and wind now are so cheap and getting cheaper. They're off the shelf. They can be ramped up to produce more. They can be put up by any contractor who can fix a kitchen or build a house. We have enormous labor supply for doing it. We have enormous capacity. It's, in fact, finding the resources, and we have enormous resources in the world and in this country. It seems to me a political question that it's going to require the kind of movement you were talking about. A movement in the streets, but also in the streets right next to the legislators and the PUCs in the hearings. In fact, instead of hundreds of people in those hearings, thousands, and instead of thousands in the streets, hundreds of thousands. And I think people are waking up, and that's a possibility. Anyway, Patrick, that's my challenge.
Yeah. No question, cities have a key role to play. Cities are also fiscally constrained. To me, it comes to a point that I've increasingly come to in recent years, which is that we don't win this on our own. We don't win this as climate alone. We win it as part of a broader progressive victory. One of those victories is more progressive taxation, wealth taxes. I mean, you know, my God, billionaire wealth has gone from $1 trillion in 2000 to $13 trillion this year. We need to recapture some of that wealth for the public good. So we need to really be aligning with broader progressive forces for racial justice, for equitable taxation, for generally an improvement in the position of working class people. So that's where, you know, that's where money can come from. I mean, cities need to rebuild. I mean, cities right now are the source of something like 80% of the greenhouse gases in the world. I mean, in terms of the goods coming in, the electricity coming in. So cities can be actors. And yeah, Portland has a problem in that it is captured by PacifiCorp and Portland General Electric. There have been many attempts to create a public utility district in Portland. It always falls short. You know, try again. That is a matter for public mobilization. But yeah, you know, I have no argument with that. I think there should be a lot of focus on state and city policies. I think there should be popular mobilizations around them. There, you know, there is to some extent. You know, in Seattle, we have forwarded with allies in the environmental justice movement the Seattle Green New Deal, where we're talking about, you know, real changes such as getting gas out of homes, improving transit, especially improving transit in areas with affordable housing. We have connected the issue of affordable housing to climate because, you know, here in our techno metropolis, a lot of the lower income and moderate income people are getting forced out in the suburbs where they have to drive. So we've connected those issues up here, and we are working with allies in the people of color communities. We've linked up with the Defund the Cops movement because a lot of money goes to the cops right now, and our militarized police forces that really needs to go into social programs and affordable housing. You know, we need to make these broad progressive alignments that have a program that really addresses what we now call climate justice. We need to be working with people of color communities, disadvantaged communities. I think the 350s in different areas are pretty advanced in this. And yeah, you know, I got no argument in needing to focus on urban issues at all. I mean, we do that here in Seattle. And that probably summarizes it.
Yes, I completely agree. It has to be a mass movement that meets the needs of the great majority of people who live here. I think they're waking up, as you pointed out. The time is short, but the urgency of the matter will become very clear as the climate scientists predict weather disasters will increase, as will the recognition by people that it's a threat to their lives and particularly their children. I think we can look forward to that movement really enlarging and doing what we can to advance that struggle. Thanks so much for talking to us today, Patrick.
You're welcome. Glad to be back on KBOO.
Take care. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.